Once upon a time, there were four little rabbits.
How old are you, Johnny? She asked.
16.
We few, we happy few, we band of brothers.
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times.
A wise old king once said, "Of the making of books, there is no end." How true today. Of the overabundance of writing published each year, what's worth reading? The answer is simple. Read only the best. Come join the discussion on Just the Best Literature.
Well, hello again, everyone. Thanks for listening in today. For with our last two programs, we discussed Lawrence's driving desire to lead the Arabs to take Syria as quickly as possible and to claim that geography for their own. And of course, Lawrence wanted to do this so that the French or the British could not claim it. Now, we must remember that Lawrence truly was creative, and he was skilled at organizing and winning battles. And hopefully you understood that from our last couple programs. But for today, what I want to do is I want to begin our last two programs on Michael Korda's biography of Lawrence. Now, we will not discuss all the remaining chapters. They're actually quite long and extensive. But I am going to give you some final highlights to spur you on to complete reading the book on your own. Now, I can't stress enough how important this book is to understanding the Middle East of today. And I'm going to give you some highlights even in the next program that will maybe help you to see that. But one of the things I think we have to realize with Lawrence is that even though he was really a brilliant military strategist, even though he was really a brilliant soldier in the sense and very courageous and very exciting, I think, even for the Arabs to have him lead them, he did have his failures. And he did have his, let's say, his bad times, certainly, when he was in the Middle East. Now, I think one of the things that we have to accept about Lawrence is that he wanted to accomplish big and strategic battles using the difficult-to-manage Arab soldiers. Now, he really was for them. And although he was successful at destroying trains, he really was not satisfied with just taking trains. I mean, he did develop some really great guerrilla tactics to do that. But to gain Damascus for the Arabs, it would require much bigger challenges, and he was a young man with bold ambitions and courage. And we have to see that, and we have to kind of laud him for that. Now, after not being able to take the water station at Mudawara, and we covered that in the last couple of programs, he did settle for trains. But he did know that he was going to have to go after some bigger sites if he was going to, well, get the Arabs to Syria. But also, he didn't want to just do this for himself or for the Arabs. He also wanted to please Allenby. He and Allenby were, they were really very much in favor of each other. The two most unlikely characters, I think, or let's say military men. And so essentially what Lawrence wanted to do is he wanted to blow the bridge at the Yarmouk Gorge. Now, it's also known as the bridge at Tel el-Shahab. And so, again, he wanted to do this not just for himself, but he wanted to please Allenby. He didn't feel like it was really, well, doing great stuff to give Allenby trains. He wanted to give him much more than that. And, of course, you probably have read about Beersheba and how Lawrence was there to support him, and he was his, on his flank to help him to be able to get in. And of course, they did have that very great success at Beersheba. Now, taking this bridge at Yarmouk, this was, as I think Korda brings out really well in the book, this was a very dangerous operation. And I think what you ought to do is make sure that you read pages 334. To 340. I mean, read the whole thing, and don't fail to read. I'm not going to be able to read all the details of it, but the thing is, I think there's a lot in there for you. Now, Lawrence, he really did perform some amazing heroic acts to destroy that bridge. I mean, if you hopefully you've already read into this chapter. And essentially, we're only about halfway through the book. And the thing is, we're not going to be able to finish the whole book, let's say, on the radio. But you can certainly finish it. But essentially what he did, if you have to kind of imagine him in his robes and his headdress with his dagger. And but he did. He walked on ice and mud. This is frozen ice and mud. He walked on bare feet. And to be able to, you know, set this bridge, set the mine at the bridge, to blow this bridge up. And it really was an impossible feat. You have to understand they're in a gorge. And here he is. He's trying to carry these mines, which were, you know, sacks of, explosives, and not drop them. And, you know, it was, horrible rain, horrible wind, horrible conditions. And, essentially he's on rocks and mud and ice. And, he's getting his feet all cut up. There were Turkish soldiers around. He was under constant fire. I mean, he could have been shot by a bullet at any time. But this man, this young man, and I can honestly say that since I'm 67, he was much younger than I am. He was like not worried about this. He just kept pushing himself, and. But the sad thing is, they couldn't blow the bridge. And they went through all this effort, traveling through hot deserts, traveling here, traveling there, to get there. And then here the mine slipped out of the hands of one of the other Arabs, and it went down into the ravine. And there was no way they could get it out. So it was a humiliating failure for him. Absolutely humiliating for Lawrence, because he just did not like failure. Now, what he did then is, if you go ahead and read that section of the book, he did then go ahead and destroy the train of generals. And I know we've talked about that in the previous program, but still, he felt that was a cheap thing to hand over to Allenby after Allenby took Beersheba. So essentially then, and again, we're trying to finish up the later chapter, 1917, the uncrowned king of Arabia. I'm trying to kind of finish this out for you quickly. But then Lawrence developed these bold plans to take Dara. And again, I think early on in the last two programs, I told you we're not going to talk about everything that happened to him at Dara. But I think what it just shows there is that when we look at someone like Lawrence, and again, I don't think it's wrong, or I don't think it's saying, being overly effusive to call him a hero, because he proved himself. I mean, here he decided that if he couldn't give Allenby the bridge, well, then he was going to try and take Dara. Now, one of the things, remember, that the reason why this was so important, it was even important for the Arabs, and it's essentially what it is, that the Arabs were really good at guerrilla warfare anyway, because that's kind of the way they fought. They were not organized troops. They were not organized, like the British were. And the British were always concerned is, could they be trusted to be able to take a city and then hold it? And even Lawrence had his doubts about that. And so here, Dara was actually a small place. And he thought it would be a good test case to see if they could take it. Now, the fact that Lawrence was this very meticulous military genius, he didn't really rely on anybody else. He wanted to see things for himself. It's like he became his own spy, and he decided to go into Dara on his own and scope out the city to see if it could be taken. Now, this in a sense was a very bold move. And it maybe not have been very smart on Lawrence's part, because he was a wanted man. I mean, there were posters of him. Let's say if you think about the Old West in America, there were posters saying, here's the one. Here's a picture of the most wanted man. There was money to be obtained by ferreting out Lawrence or finding him. And of course, Lawrence believes that even after this whole thing at Dara, there were people that did betray him. The Arabs, remember now, they were not the most loyal to the British, or maybe they weren't as all loyal to Faisal as people might have think. But essentially, he was captured and he was tortured at Dara. Now, again, I do want to read you a paragraph from this, and let's look at it specifically from a military campaign. And, of course, Korda gives us a little bit of insight we might just mention, but we're not going to get into any psychoanalysis of Lawrence. He says, probably no incident in Lawrence's life looms larger than Dara or is more controversial. His decision to go there is hotly debated and often criticized, but Lawrence had always been as reckless when it came to his own safety as he was careful of the life of others. Indeed, he made a point of courting danger. And I want you to remember that statement when we get into the next program, because we're going to talk about how he died. And this is probably one of the reasons why he died in the way he did, because he was reckless and he didn't care about his own safety and he did love to court danger. It said, and it is also hard to calculate the degree to which his failure destroyed the bridge at Tel al-Shabaab weighed on him. His admiration for Allenby was enormous, uncomplicated, and sincere. Allenby's huge, commanding presence made him seem to Lawrence like a natural feature, something immovable and irresistible, a mountain perhaps, and having failed to keep what he regarded as a promise to Allenby, he felt obligated to provide an acceptable substitute. Capturing Dara would be as good as destroying the bridge at Tel al-Shahab, or even better. Now, we have to, see that there was a, kind of maybe a good military thinking there. Now, even Lawrence feels like he was betrayed at Dara, that someone, tipped off the authorities that he was there. And, of course, we know that they did torture him and in a very cruel and shameful manner. And it did affect him, for the rest of his life, really. And, again, we're not going to psychoanalyze Lawrence, but he was shattered by this experience. And I think in many ways, if you understand it, this is the initial cause that led him to resign and leave the Middle East. Now, we're going to come to that probably more in the next program. But one thing I want to just leave with you as we go through this program is even though Lawrence did, resign temporarily from the Middle East, he was not destined to leave the Middle East a failure. And I think you'll see what I'm going to be talking about this, or why I'm talking about this, as we get close to the end of this chapter. Now, I would like to skip to the end of this chapter somewhat. And, there were, like I said, disasters that Lawrence experienced. And I think if you know anything about true heroes, why they do have great success, but, they also, have huge failures and huge problems to deal with. And of course, Lawrence, he studied heroes. He would have known about that. And of course, we've talked about in previous programs how he just totally would put himself through very hard things to get him, to get used to being under hardship. And certainly he did set a major example with that, in his life in the desert. Now, one of the things that we know that Lawrence really feared is he feared the British would take Jerusalem. And so when he was losing out, when he lost the bridge, when he lost the opportunity to take Dara, in some ways Allenby was pushing forward and he was actually in some ways, being held back. And I think, remember now, when we talked about with Mr. Brent Nachtigall, we talked about the Balfour Declaration, is that I think you can almost see God's hand in this, that he did want the British to get in there and take Jerusalem, and even though the Middle East today is still still really, there is no peace there. It's really still a very messy situation. For God's own purposes, you know, the Jews are, you know, in Jerusalem. But essentially what happened is during all this time, Allenby was moving, God Beersheba, he was moving towards Jericho, and eventually the Turks just fled. They abandoned Jerusalem. And let me just read you this quote. This is a quote on page 352. It says, "The Turks had abandoned Jerusalem, and for many, including Lawrence himself, the taking of the city by British and Commonwealth troops was the most memorable event of the war. Allenby, with an unfailing genius for the big event, was determined to make the most of his capture of the Holy City and left orders at Aqaba that Lawrence was to join him at once. Lawrence not unnaturally supposed that Allenby was going to give him hell for his failure at Yarmouk, but an airplane had been sent for him, and he was flown directly to Allenby's headquarters in the field north of Gaza, still barefoot and in white robes. To his surprise, the interview with Allenby went better than he imagined. The breakthrough at Gaza and Beersheba and the fall of Jerusalem had pleased Allenby so much that he didn't seem to mind about the bridge at Tel al-Shahab. He had wanted the Turks to the east of the Dead Sea and the Jordan River to be harassed, preoccupied, and disorganized as he advanced from Beersheba so that he could not be attacked on his right from the desert. And God knows Lawrence had achieved this, and with fewer than 100 armed men. As a sign of his regard, Allenby insisted that Lawrence should be present as part of his staff when he entered the city. So Lawrence borrowed bits and pieces of uniform from other staff officers and resplendent with the red staff collar tabs and a major's crown on each shoulder, he walked behind Allenby on December 11th through the Jaffa Gate into Jerusalem." So here it was, it's something that, T.E. Lawrence would have not wanted, but still he knew it was an exciting move, and the taking of Jerusalem was great. And of course, Lloyd George, got what he wanted. He wanted Jerusalem for the British people. Now, I want to skip over to page 353, and I just want to read you another quote here. This was a big deal, and of course, you know, one of his best friends, Ronald Storrs, wanted to really make a lot of, PR about it. He wanted to do a film about it. So this is the middle of page 353, and this is leading me to what I really want to title this program. It says, Storrs, who had missed the official entry, arrived to take up his surprising new duties as the first military governor of Jerusalem since Pontius Pilate. So can you imagine, here one of, T.E. Lawrence's best friends is now the military governor of Jerusalem since Pontius Pilate. So that really connects a lot of history, doesn't it? And so it is, it's just, when I read this paragraph, I thought, wow, this is really... really kind of exciting. And here Lawrence is really at the center of all this. It says, again, Storrs had the temporary rank of lieutenant colonel. It was in this capacity that Storrs first met Lowell Thomas, the brash American journalist, documentary filmmaker, and inventor of the travelogue. Thomas was a former gold miner, short order cook, and newspaper reporter with the gift for gab, who had studied for a master's degree at Princeton, where he also taught of all things oratory, and who had been sent by Woodrow Wilson, a former president of Princeton, to make a film that would drum up America's enthusiasm for the war and for the new allies now that the United States had joined it, and an early and groundbreaking attempt at a propaganda film. So here they meet this filmmaker, Lowell Thomas, and the point is that they wanted to begin do PR work. Even Woodrow Wilson wanted PR work about what was happening in the Middle East, and of course they wanted to center around Jerusalem. But guess who gets in the middle of it? And I'm sure you don't have to go very far. We know that here Lawrence gets in the middle of all of this. This is page 354. And Here, Thomas runs into Lawrence in the most unusual way. It says, Thomas, who had the American go-getter's ability to move like lightning when his interest or self-interest was aroused, quickly had himself accredited as a war correspondent, and he arrived in Jerusalem with Harry Chase in time to film Allenby's entrance into the city. This was going to be a worldwide scoop. Sometime later, he was buying dates on Christian Street when he saw a group of Arabs approaching. His curiosity was excited by a single Bedouin who stood out in sharp relief from his companions. He was wearing an ogle, a kafafa, an abba such as were only worn by Near Eastern potentates. In his belt was fastened a sort of curved sword of a prince of Mecca, insignia worn by the descendants of the prophet. It was not merely his costume, nor yet the dignity with which he carried 5 feet three, making him every inch a king or perhaps a caliph in disguise. But this young man was a blonde as a Scandinavian, in whose veins flowed Viking blood and the cool traditions of fords and sagas. My first thought as I glanced at his face was he might be one of the younger apostles turned to life, or returned to life, excuse me. His expression was serene, almost saintly, in his selflessness and repose. So Lyle Thomas goes back and tells Storrs all about it. And he says, who is this guy? And it says, the last paragraph says, Storrs did not even allow Thomas to finish his question. He opened the door to the adjoining room where, seated at the same table where von Falkenhayn had worked out his unsuccessful plan for defeating Allenby, was the Bedouin prince, deeply absorbed in a ponderous tome on archaeology. Introducing us, the governor said, I want you to meet Colonel Lawrence, the uncrowned king of Arabia. So essentially, the reason I bring that out is essentially what happened is there was this Lawrence cult that was started. And, you know, it really is amazing. We have to understand this somewhat. T. Lawrence was a genuine hero. And if you look on page 355, this gets us into chapter 8. It says, you know, Lawrence became this cult figure. And in many ways, when we get into the next program, I'm going to show you that he's still, his legend is still going on. It says, at the very top of this page, the title of the chapter is Triumph and Tragedy. We'll get into this a little bit. It says, two names had come to dominate Cairo. Ronald Storrs wrote concerning the end of 1970, Allenby, now striding like a giant up the Holy Land, and Lawrence, no longer a meteor in renown, but a fixed star. Now, that's great writing, and that's a really good explanation of, T.E. Lawrence. He was no longer a meteor. He was now a fixed star. And so it really is amazing. Corda goes on, Lawrence's name was already being placed in conjunction with Allenby's as if they were partners, rather than a full general who was the commander-in-chief and a temporary major who was a guerrilla leader. Lyle Thomas was not the only person to recognize that Lawrence was a great story, perhaps the great story of the war in the Middle East, as well as a genuine hero in which the individual acts of bravery were being submerged in the public's mind by the sheer mass of combatants. People hungered for color, for a clearly defined personality, for a hint of chivalry and panache, rather than the endless casualty lists and the sheer horror of mechanized, muddy, anonymous death on a hitherto unimaginable scale. So we have to remember at this time, this period of time in World War I, the people were so devastated by the carnage. And, America and Britain and Europe, they wanted their hero. And, of course, the hero, I guess his name is Lyle Thomas, he used, T.E. Lawrence. But also then the Germans wanted their hero at this time. And of course they had Manfred Freer von Richenhofen, or the famous Red Baron. So he became, the hero of, the Germans. And of course Lawrence became the hero for, the British and the Americans. It says, Lawrence's cult had started long before his arrival in Jerusalem. Indeed, it had its beginning among a much more critical group, his fellow soldiers. His flowing robes, his apparent indifference to fatigue, pain, and danger, his ability to lead desert Bedouin, and the fact that he appeared to be fighting a war of his own devising with no orders from anybody except Allenby, all these gave Lawrence a legendary status well before the arrival of Lowell Thomas and Harry Chase. Lawrence had already mastered the art of seeking to avoid the limelight while actually backing into it, as his friend Bernard Shaw would write years later, when he was in the middle of the stage with 10 limelights blazing on him, everybody pointed to him and said, "See, he's hiding. He hates publicity." And of course, that's really kind of a humorous thing, because I think in some ways, Lawrence was, a very private person. But also, I don't think that that Lawrence, resisted the limelight either. And so, that's just really, really interesting writing. And so one thing I just wanted to say, though, is unfortunately we're running out of time for this program. And so next time we'll conclude our series on Michael Corder's book, Hero, The Life and Legend of Lawrence of Arabia. In the first week of November, we will begin a new series titled A Tribute to Charles Krauthammer. Now for this series, we will be reading selected portions of his book of essays entitled Things That Matter. You can buy this book at Amazon.com. You can find a used copy of the book at abebooks.com. Of course, you can also check your local library. Please write me any comments you may have at jbl@pcog.org. You can follow JB on Twitter at jbliterature1. And you can also follow JB on Facebook. Simply search for Just the Best Literature. So, until next time, keep reading.
You've been listening to Just the Best Literature on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, streaming online at kpcg.fm and thetrumpet.com.